Vandenberg was vice president of his high school literary society, winning the Silver Prize in the Michigan State Oratorical Contest. Truman took no interest in writing or reciting. Their political careers followed different paths. Vandenberg, always passionate about foreign affairs, was a full-throated isolationist through the 1930s, right up until December 1941. He supported the Neutrality Acts prior to the war, and opposed lend-lease aid to Britain after it broke out. "We have tossed Washington's farewell address into the discard," he wrote in March 1941, after the aid bill passed the Senate. "We have thrown ourselves squarely into the power politics and the power wars of Europe, Asia, and Africa. We have taken the first step upon a course from which we can never hereafter retreat." But everything changed in December. "My convictions regarding international cooperation and collective security for peace," he later wrote, "took firm form on the afternoon of the Pearl Harbor attack. That day ended isolationism for any realist." Truman, in contrast, never experienced an epiphany in worldview. His passion in the Senate was rooting out domestic corruption. Having been a compromise candidate for the vice presidency, he was hurled into the front lines of foreign affairs after FDR's death, just months after reluctantly assuming the job. But he was a quick learner. And though legend would label him decisive, it is perhaps more accurate to say he did not second-guess himself after deciding. He hated the job of president, but carried it out without regard or doubling back. Vandenberg had coveted the presidency for years. FDR introduced him to Britain's King George VI in 1939, saying unsmilingly, "Here's a chap who thinks he's going to succeed me in the White House." But he isn't. Though he had enormous policy differences with FDR, particularly over what he saw as the president's coddling of the belligerent Soviet government, Vandenberg still admired him as a gallant soul and a superb example of personal courage. Truman had no more in common with Vandenberg temperamentally than did FDR. But there was a complementarity, an absence of clashing egos, that allowed them to work together with ease. The country would be fortunate in the pairing. Kennan produced an important memo for Acheson on May 16, 1947, a dry run for the policy planning staff paper, PPS-1, requested by Marshall. He began by paying obeisance to the high quality and value of the SWNCC work on European recovery before delicately indicating that he would be making suggestions which will affect the assumptions and points of departure on which the SWNCC is proceeding. Kennan then laid out the principles on which his staff was working, creating a shining contrast with the verbose jumble emanating from the SWNCC. "A 4 to 5 year schedule of American aid," Kennan said, "would supplement a program of intramural economic collaboration among the Western European countries." Walter Lippmann, when visiting Kennan at the War College in April, had suggested inviting the Europeans to draw up such a plan, and this may have had some influence on Kennan's thinking. Notably, no mention was made, in contrast to the SWNCC report, of any requirement for trade with Eastern Europe. Participation would be left open for states within the Russian orbit, which would first have to guarantee that their participation will be constructive. As for the Western countries, no aid could be forthcoming without guarantees that preclude communist sabotage or misuse. Western Europe as an organized political and economic construct was here taking shape, its boundaries marked by willingness and ability to participate in an American-led recovery program, its outlook marked by resistance to communism. Foreshadowing the emergence of a new West German state, Kennan said that occupation policies in Germany would have to be altered to ensure that the Western zone made the maximum contribution to the economic restoration of Western Europe. The French, he argued, would have to be forced to accept a revitalized Germany, and the British to accept an integrated Western Europe. Outside of such a new construct, Britain would appear to have no future, and the United States would have to consider abandoning her strategically and politically. This refrain would be replayed by American observers of Britain's testy relationship with the European continent repeatedly over the coming decades. Equally notable was Kennan's insistence that the administration be careful not to talk in terms of loans when there is no plausible prospect of repayment. Assistance needed to take the form of outright grants. This was a further slap at Morgenthau's legacy. Loans to bankrupt Britain to tide it through a post-war transition, and loans to allied nations through a new IMF to restart global trade. Loans that in theory cost America nothing, and in practice, achieved nothing. It was time for the U.S. government, in Kennan's rendering, to level with the American heartland, speaking frankly about the requirements for peace and prosperity. It would need to articulate what forms of engagement were required and what it would cost. Yet a concrete outline for the Marshall Plan only took shape, Acheson later reflected, with the return of Will Clayton from a six-week desolation tour of Western Europe on May 19th. While Kennan was laboring away on PPS-1, Clayton was organizing his own thoughts for Marshall. Will was genuinely alarmed that Europe was on the brink of disaster, recounted Paul Nitze, then a 40-year-old deputy director of the Department's Office of International Trade Policy. Clayton now communicated his diagnosis to Acheson in a consequential memo dated May 27th. Acheson contrasted it with Kennan's report, which dwelled more on difficulties and dangers than on the imperative need for action. Action was Clayton's preoccupation. Acheson, who considered Clayton one of the most powerful and persuasive advocates he ever dealt with in government, sent the memo on at once to the general. It would have a powerful impact, both upon the content of Marshall's forthcoming speech and probably upon his decision to make it. Even more so in recitation than in writing, Clayton was able to impart to his audience a sense of urgency. His stories of fearful peasants, workers, and merchants hoarding to avoid hunger were vivid and compelling in a way that numbers, dire as they were, failed to capture. Parisians were starving. But why? Clayton explained that it was not that farmers could not grow enough, or that they could not deliver what they grew. Farmers would simply not supply cities with food as long as the latter could produce nothing to offer in return. Money was losing acceptability as a voucher for tomorrow's goods. Inflation was destroying its value. It is now obvious, Clayton wrote, that we grossly underestimated the destruction to the European economy by the war. We understood the physical destruction, but failed to understand how economic dislocation, nationalization of industries, drastic land reform, severing of long-standing commercial ties, and disappearance of private commercial firms through death or loss of capital would destroy the productive apparatus. Capitalism, Clayton was sure, was the source of Europe's former economic strength, and reviving it was essential to preventing social and political disintegration. Large-scale aid, Clayton said, was necessary to save Europe from starvation and chaos. He estimated the need at $18 to $21 billion, $227 billion in today's money, spread over 3 years. Nitze estimated $25 billion, $270 billion today, over 5 years. But aid was not enough. Clayton, again like Kennan, wanted a reconstruction plan to be drawn up by the principal European nations, the UK, France, and Italy. Yet whereas Kennan envisioned the United States providing only friendly assistance in its drafting, Clayton envisioned a more assertive American role. In Acheson's words, Clayton wanted the plan merely to appear to come from Europe. He would, further, brook no outside interference. Other countries might pitch in with surplus food and raw materials, but this was not to be another UNRWA. The United States, he said, must run this show. Clayton insisted that the plan should be based on a European Economic Federation on the order of the Belgium-Netherlands-Luxembourg Customs Union. Europe, he insisted, cannot recover if her economy continues to be divided into many small watertight compartments. Clayton was no theoretician, but the theory of customs unions, the idea that maximizing output required free movement of the various factors of production, was in vogue and would have appealed to his free market instincts. Customs unions were multi-state free trade zones with common external tariffs. Economists at the time argued that the rise of the United States to industrial supremacy in the early 20th century had been assisted by the fact that it operated as such a union among its semi-autonomous states, allowing the country to take advantage of economies of scale and specialization according to comparative advantage. Europe, Clayton believed, needed to follow that model to catch up. Clayton further believed that the Bretton Woods vision of a stable global trading and payments system could not be realized without political action to restore a balance or equilibrium in world trade. Yet such equilibrium had not been seen since 1914, when it fell victim to the catastrophe of World War I and the collapse of the classical gold standard. Now, in the wake of a Second World War, Europe could not export enough to pay for essential imports from the United States. Creating a United States of Europe, so the new thinking went, was the innovation necessary to restore equilibrium. Prominent Republicans, such as future Secretary of State John Foster Dulles, shared this belief. Truman himself laid out a vision of it shortly after assuming the presidency in the spring of 1945. Pointing Stimson to a map, he explained that the challenge of securing a post-war settlement was to help unify Europe by linking the breadbasket of the East with the industrial centers of the Northwest through a flow of free trade. Stimson agreed, believing further that German economic integration and reintegration with wider Europe had to be a critical component of this vision. Equally important, failure to act upon these convictions would mean that Europe would remain dependent on U.S. aid. The old approach, Reston wrote in the Times, was to deal with the shattered economies of the several nations one at a time, lending now to Britain, then to France, then to Italy, etc. But this had failed. Recovery in May 1947 seemed as far off as it did after Germany's surrender 2 years earlier. The new approach is based on the growing conviction that the problems of all these countries are interrelated, and that Europe cannot recover by shoring up one at a time the various national economies. Over in London, the Economist cheered the new approach. "Let the United States knock heads together and impose an agreement," it said. "There are plenty of Europeans who would welcome American dictation if it were for a good cause." On May 23rd, Acheson received PPS-1, in fulfillment of Marshall's directive, a general orientation plan for aid to Western Europe. He'd read as if the prose were Kennan's, and as with every paper written under his direction, it was. Kennan began almost defensively with a statement of what the plan was not. Communist activities were not the root of the difficulties of Western Europe, he wrote. Rather, the present crisis was a product of the disruptive effect of the war on the economic, political, and social structure of Europe, and a profound exhaustion of physical plant and spiritual vigor. This situation has been aggravated by the division of the continent into East and West. But this division was, of course, a product of the Soviet occupation of the Eastern continent and the installation of communist-led governments. And further communist successes would create serious danger to American security, Kennan wrote. Yet American aid had to be directed not to the combating of communism as such, but to the restoration of the economic health and vigor of European society. It was economic maladjustment which makes European society vulnerable to exploitation by any and all totalitarian movements, a vulnerability which Russian communism is now exploiting. The concision of the prose created the risk that readers would perceive wrongly that the PPS was downplaying the Soviet-backed communist threat in Europe. But Kennan was anxious to frame communism as just another brand of totalitarianism, which the American public already understood to be a threat. "The United States' approach to world problems," he said, "must not appear to be a defensive reaction to communist pressure." This appearance had colored the media's interpretation of the Truman Doctrine, which had become shorthand for a blank check to give economic and military aid to any area in the world where the communists show signs of being successful. Partly to correct this misunderstanding, the Europeans themselves would need to draw up the economic program. There was, finally, the critical question of how to define the program's borders. To exclude the East was to invite blame for creating the Iron Curtain. To include it was to invite Soviet sabotage. The solution, Kennan argued, was to advance the project as a general European, not just Western European, one, but in a manner ensuring that the Russian satellite countries would either exclude themselves by unwillingness to accept the proposed conditions, or agree to abandon the exclusive orientation of their economies. Either way the satellites chose, the United States would win diplomatically. Kennan's objective for American economic intervention was clear: ensuring Western Europe's ability to resist communist subversion. But as for the form that intervention would take, he was groping blindly. He was no economist, and had no aptitude for playing one. The two suggestions he lobbed out meekly were to find a way to move Rhineland coal to areas of need and to provide immediate unspecified assistance to Italy. His critical insight was that there was a psychological precondition for Europe's revival, and that bold American action was necessary to create it. Yet no further could he go without others, who would be essential to transforming Marshall's message into a plan. Kennan provided the strategic logic behind a European recovery program. Clayton offered the vision of an integrated Western Europe that could carry it out. The third major influence on the program's development was not even present in Washington. His views were never solicited, and he would remain an outsider at every point in the process. Lucius Dubignon Clay was born in Marietta, Georgia, in 1898, 1 year later than he claimed in order to qualify for West Point. His father, a three-term senator, passed down to him a knack for navigating obstacles in Washington. Being of a more monocratic bent, however, the younger Clay resisted the many calls to follow his father's path into electoral politics. In his graduating class of 137, Clay came in first in history, first in English, and 128th in conduct. "If we lived in an earlier age, he would have been a baron or a duke," observed a Washington colleague. "He would be a benevolent one, but he'd be an autocrat nonetheless." Like the others in the top quarter of his class, he was assigned to the Army Corps of Engineers in 1918. Though he persisted in seeking out combat opportunities, he would rise to the rank of Brigadier General in 1942, at age 43, the youngest ever, without seeing battle. In his various civil and military engineering posts in the United States, Latin America, and Asia, he developed an unrivaled reputation for bringing order, discipline, focus, and accountability to the most complex logistical tasks. In March of 1942, Marshall appointed him director of materiel in the War Department, where he managed the Army's prodigious procurement activities and administered Allied military aid. There he became known as a formidable master of bureaucratic bottlenecks. He was, according to one colleague, forceful, persuasive, and bright as hell. In October 1944, Clay transferred to Europe to manage logistics for General Eisenhower. But the stint was brief. Burns, then director of the Office of War Mobilization, called him back in November to take over management of war production. The personal bonds he established with Eisenhower and Burns would remain strong in the years to come, yet he lasted less than 5 months in that job before FDR, acting on the force of a remarkable consensus among his advisors, tapped him to be Deputy Military Governor of Germany on March 31, 1945. In practice, he would run the American zone of the country. With Germany in physical, financial, and moral ruin, it was a daunting assignment. His prior experience had given him as much familiarity with an entire economy of a nation as anyone could have. Yet knowing little of the German nation and nothing of the language, he tried to beg out of it. Once he understood the matter was settled, however, he focused on clearing away constraints on his ability to run the country. Enlisting Burns' support, he ensured that he would report to Eisenhower and not to a bureaucracy in Washington. The official order confirming his new position came down on April 17th, 5 days after FDR's death. Press coverage of Clay's appointment was enthusiastic, although in part for the wrong reason. The Washington Post thought that the task called for authoritarianism, which Clay would muster unashamedly. The New York Herald Tribune concurred, suggesting that it meant life will be hard for the Germans. Yet Clay would press his authority to make it otherwise. He was determined to create a well-fed citizenry that could rebuild the country and, in the shortest possible order, govern it effectively and responsibly. In this effort, he would find himself confronting his government's official policy head-on. Clay's appointment had been vigorously supported by Treasury Secretary Morgenthau, yet the two could not have disagreed on occupation policy more completely. Clay was not given the Occupation Directive, JCS, 1067, until he boarded the plane for Paris, and did not read the Morgenthau plan upon which it was based until arriving at Eisenhower's headquarters in Reims. But Clay quickly realized that the cost to the United States was going to be terrific unless we could get this thing moving again, which we were not permitted to do if we literally followed our instructions. He also thought the directive too vindictive to have long suited the American people. His issues with it were more than technical, they were moral and strategic. Clay's unvarnished views on Germany were summarized in a memo he wrote to Marshall on May 2, 1947, 6 weeks after he formally became military governor. Germany, Clay said, was bankrupt. It avoided starvation only through Washington's disease and unrest appropriations, and had no prospect of supporting itself without the means to pay for imports. Its coffers were empty, its debts unmanageable, its credit non-existent. And Allied policy blocked all avenues to profitable export. Without change, the country would become an intolerable drain on American resources and political energies. Clay had fought to get the Occupation Directive repealed and replaced in the spring of 1945, but got nowhere. He would repeatedly exploit its disease and unrest loophole, which gave him the authority to deviate from its harsh approach, but there were limits to how far even he could bend a policy without breaking it. He was convinced that the directive's requirement that he bust up large agricultural estates, which were small by American standards, was economic madness. But he did it. If we hadn't had 1067, I am sure that our original approach would have been quite different, he reflected years later. We would have been instructed from the very beginning to assist in getting the Germans back on their feet. Making them citizens of the world again sooner would have helped to get Europe back on its feet again sooner, and at less cost. In a March 1946 cable to Washington, Clay put the issue in the context of containing communism. There is no choice between becoming a communist on 1,500 calories and a believer in democracy on 1,000 calories, he wrote. It is my sincere belief that our proposed ration allowance in Germany will not only defeat our objectives in Middle Europe, but will pave the road to a communist Germany. Clay's thinking had notable influence on Marshall in the wake of his fruitless efforts in Moscow to engage Stalin in a new cooperative approach to Germany. The directive be damned. Marshall instructed Clay to put Bisonia on a self-sustaining basis. The U.S. and U.K. would take the first steps toward localizing administrative power in Germany on May 23, 1947, when they formally agreed to German participation on a new bizonal economic council, a precursor to a West German government. The moral and economic albatross of JCS 1067, which now seemed purposeless in light of America's atomic monopoly, would be replaced in July by JCS 1779, which made the creation of a self-supporting German economy a primary goal of American occupation policy. The United States would thereafter be committed to West German economic unification and limited self-government. By October, even the denazification program was to be handed over to Germans. Abandoning denazification was more a matter of necessity than enlightenment. The United States and Britain could no longer afford Germany as an enemy. As Noel Annan, a British intelligence officer in Germany, put it, "It is odious to find oneself in alliance with a people who had been willing to go along with Hitler to keep communism at bay." But the best hope for the West was to encourage the Germans themselves to create a Western democratic state. They provided such encouragement not merely by alleviating physical deprivations, but by permitting an indigenous German culture of sorts to begin reviving in the bombed-out cities. In the midst of the most desolate metropolis in the world, Vienna-born Jewish novelist and journalist Hilda Spiel wrote of Berlin, among gray and bleached skeletons of houses, theaters of a splendor such as a Londoner might seek in vain are rising again. Much had changed since 1945, when the Americans lured Germans into theaters with promises of cowboy films, only to show them shocking footage of concentration camp liberations instead. The German and Austrian literary exile communities in the United States and Britain, many of whose prominent members were Jewish or married to Jews, were split over whether they should welcome the transformation. Perhaps the earliest sophisticated treatments of the moral question of German national war guilt to emerge from this community were Thomas Mann's Dr. Faustus, published in October 1947, and Karl Zuckmayr's The Devil's General, a play that opened to controversy and popular acclaim in Frankfurt in November. The Bisonia authorities could not begin physically reviving Germany, however, without cooperation from Germany's neighbors. Germany could not raise enough food to be self-supporting, Clay stressed, and it could not export without having its revenues from these exports confiscated by the country buying those products, since all of them held unpaid German securities. Its neighbors would not extend its trade credit, or in the case of France, even consent to the country controlling its own strategic industrial and commodity resources. This is where the wider European context became critical. German recovery would have to be embedded in a European recovery, with American grants substituting for German reparations. Contrary to Kennan and the State Department broadly, Clay held Paris and not Moscow primarily responsible for the breakdown in four-power cooperation over Germany. He considered Kennan dogmatic and dangerous in his writings on Stalin's government. The two disparaged each other's intellectual temperament, accusing the other of holding ignorant misapprehensions about the nature of the Soviet government. Clay thought Kennan remote and highbrow, dismissing him as all theory. The latter recalled a meeting between the two in Berlin in the spring of 1946, in which he was upbraided by the general over what he considered to be our anti-Soviet views at the State Department. For his part, Kennan thought Clay blinkered and naive to Stalin's agenda, chiding him for having been suckered by Zhukov's personality. Perhaps, but Clay was not dogmatic or ideological in his desire to find a modus operandi with Moscow. He was no Russophile, and insisted on dealing with Stalin from a position of strength. I don't think we would have had a Cold War if we'd kept a strong army in Europe in 1945, he would reflect decades later. His prime concern was always restoring the German economy, and he was willing to pursue it with or without Soviet cooperation. Clay's initial influence on Marshall's European recovery ideas was modest. Marshall would unveil them without even mentioning a role for Germany. As for Clay himself, Marshall saw him not as part of his team, but as a commander suffering from localitis, an affliction blinding him to the world beyond his own theater of responsibility. Clay saw the problem through the other end of the scope. State was, in his words, interested in Germany's relations with other countries, and not in Germany itself. But it was also true that to wean Europe off American aid and dollar dependence, there was no alternative but to reconstitute Germany's industrial capacity. Before the war, nearly 60% of all German imports came from, and 75% of all German exports went to, other European countries. Until there is a revival of Western Germany's capacity to produce and consume at reasonable levels, a later joint U.S.-UK military governor's report would argue, there is little chance of restoring the Western European standard of living to pre-war levels. Clay's contribution to a European recovery program would lay in pushing a revivified Germany from its periphery into its core. He accomplished this through dogged persistence over time, chipping away at state's inclination to keep the French calm even when it meant keeping Germany down. Marshall assembled his advisors, Acheson, Clayton, Kennan, Bolin, and Ben Cohn, on May 27th to review the PPS work. The general, breviloquent and somber, opened the discussion by stating that the administration would not sit back and do nothing while Europe faltered. Now what should they do? He stayed silent while each of them had his say. Clayton painted a grim portrait of a continent in collapse. Bolin talked of the need to begin laying the ground for Western European Economic Federation. As for Russia, he said, Kennan had it right. The proposal needed to embrace the whole of Europe, not divide it. Division would be Stalin's job. Are we safe? Marshall put back to them. In addressing this to all of Europe? What if Russia reacts affirmatively and decides to come in? This question was the heart of the matter for him. Many people in Europe were very timid about opposing the Soviet Union, he reflected years later, and I fear that if we started our plan by throwing the Soviets out, it would scare these people, and perhaps keep some of the European countries out of the program. Appearing to pick a fight with Moscow would have been a particular problem for France and Italy, where communist parties were strong and a constant threat to the stability of their weak governments. Kennan was keenly aware of the risk that the Soviet Union might accept the administration's plan. The Russians, after all, had cooperated on Bretton Woods for years, but merely as leverage to extract cheap U.S. credits. Stalin only stiff-armed the accords right at the ratification deadline at the end of 1945, when it was clear that nothing, despite the energetic efforts of Henry Dexter White, his influential source and advocate at Treasury, was forthcoming. Soviet cooperation with an American plan for Europe, Kennan knew, would signal only their interest in the dollars and intelligence-gathering opportunities it might afford, allowing them at the same time to work to undermine the recovery the plan was meant to germinate. Such a scenario assumed, of course, that Congress would even allow an aid scheme to go forward that the Soviets could steer and profit from. But courting Moscow's embrace was, to Kennan, a necessary, calculated risk. Even assuming that the communist movement could be beaten back in Western Europe, as Kennan was convinced it would, the reality would still be grim, an East-West economic and political rupture. The only question would then be whether the winds of popular judgment would waft blame toward Washington or Moscow. Kennan was determined that it'd be Moscow. This objective required that the administration, in his words, play it straight, or at least appear to. It had to force Stalin to react. Stalin could not opt in without giving up his reparations claims on Germany and opening the country's financial accounts to foreign scrutiny, both of which seemed unlikely. Still, if Russia accepted, we should welcome it, Kennan told Marshall. The United States could then treat Russia not as a beneficiary, but as a prospective donor, a supplier of free food and raw materials to Western Europe. Stalin would then walk away. Stalin could not, however, decline an American aid offer without either loosening his grip on Eastern Europe, much of which would embrace the plan, or tightening it by denying its new government the right to choose. The latter option would come at the cost of revealing his true aims before the world, not to liberate the territories he occupied, but to subjugate and exploit them. We would put Russia over the barrel, Kennan said. Either it must decline or else enter into an arrangement that would mean an ending of the Iron Curtain. Marshall, who made decisions firmly but deliberately, refused to be drawn further at that point. Conscious that any proposal for funding a massive aid program faced the prospect of a devastating congressional defeat, he warned the men against any leaks before excusing them. The next afternoon, May 28th, Carl Hummel's son, Director of State's Executive Secretariat, brought Marshall a stack of papers to sign and reminded him of open issues on which he needed to decide. One was whether he still wished to attend commencement ceremonies at Harvard on June 5th. He had turned down invitations to take an honorary degree the past 2 years, but this year had provisionally agreed. Now Marshall hesitated, reckoning he would have to speechify for his honor. What about that speech on aid to Germany they had been kicking around, Hummel's son suggested. Marshall summoned Acheson on May 29th. Was Harvard the right forum at which to say something on Europe? No, Acheson said. Commencement speeches usually get poor news coverage. The speech might fall flat. A curious reaction from a man who had just given the speech of his life at a Mississippi teacher's college. Marshall agreed the address might not make the front pages. But that would not be a bad thing. Let the ideas germinate. The timing was good. The venue was right. He ordered his acceptance cabled to Harvard. He wrote to Colonel Carter the next day asking him to have draft text prepared. It is of tremendous importance that our people understand the situation in Europe, he explained, particularly the dominant character of economic factors. It should emphasize that this was an extremely critical period through which we are passing, and that irritation and passion should have no part in the policy response. It should be broad but concise. The whole talk should be less than 10 minutes. Marshall made no mention of Russia. Carter, however, had been on his plane back from Moscow and knew that the meetings with Molotov and Stalin were impelling his boss. He asked Marshall's trusted translator, Bolin, to take the lead in drafting the text. Bolin lacked Kennan's skills as a strategic thinker. Yet despite being a wealthy blue blood who took the name Chipper, later Chip, from his fellows in Harvard's Porcellian Club, he was easygoing and bonded with people naturally. His direct language suited Marshall's style. Closeting himself for 2 days, he condensed and sharpened Kennan's and Clayton's ideas, adapting them as best he could to his master's voice. The draft then went to Clayton and Acheson for edits before going to the secretary early the following week. Marshall recounts also directing Kennan to draft something independently. The two texts were, in the end, quite apart, he judged, and he cut out segments of one and the other and blended them with his own thoughts. Marshall wrote and rewrote even as he flew to Boston on June 4th. Truman was aware of the department's efforts to craft a European aid plan, but would, remarkably, not see so much as a draft before the text was made public later that day. Marshall would years hence call this an oversight on his part. In any case, Truman kept some distance from the beginning. Anything going up to Capitol Hill bearing my name will quiver a couple of times, turn belly up and die, he told Clark Clifford, who wanted to call it the Truman Plan. I've decided to give the whole thing to General Marshall. The worst Republican on the Hill can vote for it if we name it after the general. Given the deliberate lack of fanfare surrounding the speech, pursuant to Marshall's orders, the American press took little notice of the text. But since Marshall was going to invite Europe to take the initiative, Acheson made sure that the British press would. As he had done before his Mississippi speech, Acheson met Mile, Muggeridge, and McCall for lunch shortly before the speech. The three British correspondents had by this time virtually assumed the status of the Undersecretary's Foreign Press Office. Accounts of the timing and content of their discussions differ. Mile said he and his colleagues had invited Acheson on June 2nd, with the latter never mentioning Marshall's speech. Jones said that Acheson had invited them on June 4th and had specifically told them of Marshall's speech. Acheson said he talked about the speech on June 5th. What is clear, however, is that Acheson told them Marshall was inviting Europe to present Washington with a compelling cooperative request for aid. He asked the men to telephone or cable Marshall's text to London and to make sure it got into Bevin's hands without delay. It will not matter what hour of the night it is. Wake Ernie up. On the morning of the commencement exercises, June 5th, Mile phoned his editor at the BBC in London, Tony Wigan, telling him that the text of Marshall's imminent speech was extremely important. Wigan suggested they could broadcast it, but Mile argued against. His voice is so poor. Mile said he would read the words himself. He was afraid Britons would miss the message if the transmission were left to Marshall. Indeed, the Harvard audience of 15,000 hearing Marshall that afternoon, delivering the speech in his characteristic, unemotional, clipped, bright-voweled voice, must have been at least as conscious of the limitations of the orator as they were of the importance of the oration. Acheson called the speech short, simple, and altogether brilliant. But only the first two would have been apparent to most listeners. Setting reading glasses on his nose, Marshall began with the undirected observation that the world situation is very serious. But the problem, he said, is one of such enormous complexity that the very mass of facts presented to the public make it exceedingly difficult for the man in the street to reach a clear appraisement of the situation. Furthermore, being remote from the troubled areas, it is hard for Americans to comprehend the plight and consequent reactions of the long-suffering peoples and the effect of those reactions on their governments. This served as Marshall's jumping-off point for introducing Clayton's thoughts on why the vast, visible destruction of factories, mines, and railroads as terrible as it was so much less serious than what was not visible. The dislocation of the entire fabric of the European economy. Long-standing commercial ties, private institutions, banks, insurance companies, and shipping companies, Marshall said, had disappeared through loss of capital, absorption, through nationalization, or by simple destruction. People were losing confidence in their national currencies. In consequence, the division of labor, which is the basis of modern civilization, is threatened with breakdown. Fields are being withdrawn from cultivation, creating shortages of food in towns and cities. Governments, in consequence, are being forced to spend their scarce foreign money on vital necessities from abroad, exhausting funds urgently needed for reconstruction. Europe's needs for the next 3 or 4 years vastly exceed her ability to pay, and without substantial help, she faces economic, social, and political deterioration of a very grave character. The remedy, Marshall said, lies in breaking the vicious circle and restoring the confidence, a more prosaic rendering of Kennan's spiritual vigor, of the European people in the economic future of their own countries and of Europe as a whole. Here Marshall was adumbrating Clayton's idea that revival would require not just national recovery, but advances toward European economic federation. Given the obvious consequences to the economy of the United States, of the failure to break this circle, Marshall said, again channeling Clayton, it was only logical that the United States should do whatever it is able to do to assist in this crisis. Then, in a now famous line whose inspiration was Kennan's, but whose dramatic rendering was Boland's, Marshall stated, "Our policy is directed not against any country or doctrine, but against hunger, poverty, desperation, and chaos." The phrase had been crafted so as to mark the Soviets, if they rejected the plan, as partisans of hunger, poverty, and chaos. Marshall continued, "His purpose should be the revival of a working economy in the world, so as to permit the emergence of political and social conditions in which free institutions can exist." That is, the policy was not directed against the only country it could have been directed against, the Soviet Union, but toward the advancement internationally of the free institutions, which that country opposed as a matter of ideology. Then in Marshall's first statement to elicit a reaction from the assembled, he said, "Any government that is willing to assist in the task of recovery will find full cooperation, I am sure, on the part of the United States government. Any government which maneuvers to block the recovery of other countries cannot expect help from us." Vigorous applause drowned Marshall out, forcing him to restart his subsequent sentence. Furthermore, governments, political parties, or groups which seek to perpetuate human misery in order to profit therefrom, politically or otherwise, will encounter the opposition of the United States." Again, applause. Marshall's audience had not been moved to respond to his rendering of the varieties or causes of Europe's suffering, nor had they been so moved by his calls for American action to ameliorate it. But they had been stirred by his allusions to Soviet obstructionism. Marshall's final statements of substance were those bringing forth the admonitions of both Kennan and Clayton, highlighted for the British journalists by Acheson, that the initiative must now come from the countries of Europe acting in concert. It would be neither fitting nor efficacious for this government to undertake to draw up unilaterally a program designed to place Europe on its feet economically. This is the business of the Europeans. The role of this country should consist of friendly aid in the drafting of a European program, and of later support of such a program, so far as it may be practical for us to do so. The program should be a joint one, agreed to by a number, if not all, European nations. At this point, Marshall had only the haziest of templates for what a successful program should look like. He would describe it shortly after his speech only as being somewhat along the lines of the Monnet plan, but on a much larger scale. In ad-libbed words, he ended by emphasizing his belief that the whole world of the future hangs on a proper judgment as to what must be done by the United States to bring about Europe's recovery, concluding only that the judgment had to be rendered without passion, prejudice, or the emotion of the moment. His speech was more understated than Truman's had been, and certainly less bellicose. The American press, now conditioned to the give-'em-hell-Harry approach to serious initiatives, hardly took notice. The next day's flaccid New York Times headline on the speech said it all, "Marshall pleads for European unity." The full text of Marshall's speech is provided in Appendix B. Over in London, though, the speech had scored a bullseye on Acheson's target. Bevan, who had listened to Miles' reading on the BBC, said it was like a lifeline to a sinking man. It seemed to bring hope where there was none. He cabled the State Department to inform them he was taking the initiative and heading off to Paris to get Bideau on board. "I may do Bevan an injustice," Marshall later commented, "but I had the impression at the time that part of his initiative stemmed from an ambition to be the European leader for the plan." As for Bideau, he was certain this accounts for most of his contributions. Bideau insisted that the French and British governments engage the Soviets on Marshall's initiative. He and Socialist Prime Minister Paul Ramadier were anxious not to afford the French communists opportunity to claim they were American stooges, stoking conflict with Moscow. Like Kennan, though, he was determined not to let Moscow delay or obstruct progress. Stalin would have to choose between partnership or isolation. Eleanor Roosevelt, the most influential and accomplished First Lady in American history, had been disappointed with Truman's speech in March. But Marshall's speech elated her. This was the right way, she believed, to confront Soviet expansionism without a war of ideologies. Having been a passionate supporter of the Morgenthau Plan for pastoralizing Germany, she did not yet grasp how at odds Morgenthau and Marshall would soon be. No doubt Marshall, given the widespread revulsion toward Germany, was not anxious to highlight this. Stalin, too, liked the Morgenthau Plan, but in contrast to Mrs. Roosevelt, found Marshall's speech far more menacing than Truman's. As Kennan had anticipated, the initiative took the Soviet leader by surprise. At the time, Stalin had, unlike Marshall, not yet concluded that cooperation, or his version of it, was at an end. To the contrary, while Marshall's program was taking shape, Stalin was still talking optimistically, both to American visitors and the Russian public, about progress on the German problem. A May 16th editorial in a hardline anti-Western journal highlighted the value of the Moscow conference in clearing the way, given goodwill on all sides, to the necessary, if exacting, work of reconciling the different points of view and arriving at agreed decisions. Stalin would not have disseminated such a message had he thought negotiations over Germany were at an end. Stalin further believed that cooperation should be pushed forward more broadly. Talks over Korea, where 2 years earlier the Americans had taken the Japanese surrender in the south and the Soviets in the north, were making progress. In May, Stalin instructed his delegates to reach an agreement with the Americans over forming an interim government if sufficient representation could be secured for leftist South Korean groups. But the Marshall Plan was about to change everything. 5. Trap. Molotov pored over the Russian translation of Marshall's speech, underlining phrases suggesting American intent. Very serious situation. Bodes no good for the world. Clear to everyone what effects this could have on the economy of the United States. Must do everything within its power so as to assist in the return of normal economic conditions. And most importantly, governments which seek to perpetuate human misery in order to profit therefrom politically or otherwise will encounter the opposition of the United States. He added margin scribbles on the structure of the plan, noting in particular Marshall's insistence that aid would be limited to supporting a program Europeans would develop in concert. Molotov was looking for evidence, certain it was there, of impending American economic crisis and imperialist animus. Determined to avoid a trap, he was also alert to the opportunity for setting one. Ambassador Novikov was as well. 5,000 miles away in a hostile foreign capital, however, he was doubtless conscious of the need to demonstrate his fealty to the Kremlin through a muscular display of vigilance. In a cable to Moscow from Washington on June 9, 1947, he asserted that Marshall's plan contained menacing outlines of a Western European bloc that was directed against us. But that did not mean that Moscow should reject it. To the contrary, he surmised that the State Department did not want Soviet participation. Moscow should therefore participate in order to undermine its aims. This was Marshall's fear. Had Kennan miscalculated then, in betting that Moscow would recoil from their overture? At this point, it seemed so. On June 18th, Bevin and Bideau met with Jefferson Caffery, the American ambassador to Paris. They presented him with an advance copy of an invitation they intended to deliver to the Soviet chargé that evening, inviting Molotov to three-way talks in Paris over Marshall's proposal during the week of June 23rd. Caffery reported to Marshall that the two had told him, separately, that they hoped the Soviets would refuse to cooperate. The Kremlin followed public and private reports on the meetings among the Western allies in Paris, combing for signs of duplicity. Molotov's aides warned him of evidence to conceal from the Soviet Union the already reached agreement on a number of issues, such as the establishment of a new European Economic Commission, related to the implementation of the Marshall Plan. The Americans were trying to bribe France toward the Anglo-Saxons in particular, to force the Soviet Union to accept serious concessions on the resolution of the German problem. Furthermore, plans were in place to represent the USSR as an enemy of the reconstruction and stabilization of Europe if it rejected the terms of the plan. Moscow would then be the party guilty of the division of Europe into two adversarial blocs. For Paris, this would justify France's transition into the camp of the Anglo-Saxons. Molotov was not about to let the Western schemers off easily. "At first I agreed to participate," he reflected years later, referring not just to the talks, but to the Marshall Plan itself. 3 days later, the Politburo Central Committee ratified his decision to join the talks. He cabled his acceptance on June 23rd. Molotov also instructed the Soviet ambassadors in Warsaw, Prague, and Belgrade to direct their host governments to ensure their own participation in the elaboration of the economic measures under consideration and make their own claims. The governments in Warsaw and Prague each responded to Molotov's cable with enthusiasm, beyond what was required or prudent. The Polish ambassador to Moscow replied immediately, saying, "His government is very interested in the current discussion of the aid plan and ready to participate in the exchange of opinions on this question." He emphasized that the stabilization of Poland is imperative to the conditions of stabilizing Europe. Czechoslovak Foreign Minister Jan Masaryk, son of the country's post-World War I founder, unaffiliated with any party in the coalition government, was overjoyed upon learning by radio of Molotov's decision to attend the conference. "Czechoslovakia is ready to cooperate completely," he cabled, "in the cause of creating the prerequisites for the provision of the American assistance and to propose Czech projects at an appropriate time." National Socialist Trade Minister Hubert Ripka called Molotov's unexpected move a good omen. The Yugoslav government affirmed its readiness to take part in the preliminary negotiations, provided that the initiative is based on the principles of the United Nations Charter. Yet Molotov never intended to let them negotiate terms, suggesting the confrontational stance he would take on behalf of the Eastern Bloc. The Soviet press termed the American plan the Marshall Doctrine. It was, Pravda said, part of Washington's campaign against the forces of world democracy and progress. Its aim was the quick formation of a notorious Western bloc under the unconditional and absolute leadership of American imperialism. It was a plan for political pressures with dollars and a program for interference in the internal affairs of other states. On June 24th, Molotov gave Stalin a draft of the instructions he intended to deliver to the Soviet delegation in advance of the talks. It suggests he intended to bargain hard over terms, but not to strangle the initiative. Stalin scribbled edits that show the same intent, but a more emollient tone. "Before consideration of any concrete proposals related to American aid to Europe," Molotov wrote, "the Soviet delegation must contest any terms of aid that may lead to infringement upon the sovereignty of European countries or their economic enslavement." Stalin crossed out the words, "their economic enslavement," writing in the more anodyne, disruption of their economic independence. The edits suggest he did not want to poison the well prematurely. Molotov delimited how far the Soviet delegation could go to reach agreement with the French and British. He insisted that they must block any plan that would strengthen the pre-war relations between economically separate European countries, a condition that undermined the American objective of integrating Europe. Molotov also outlined terms related to Germany. Its resources, he said, could not be utilized for stabilization of the European economy without first reaching agreement on the country's economic unity and its reparation obligations. Stalin's edits suggest a harder line here. Changing economic unity to political and economic unity, he would have had in mind Marshall's resistance to a strong German central government, resistance that served to keep the country's larger and more industrialized Western territory under American control. Stalin would not abide a plan that abetted this. Also on June 24th, Novikov cabled Molotov, expressing deeper concerns than he had previously. "The Marshall Plan," he said, "makes it appear as if the United States has decided to give the European states themselves the initiative in establishing a program of economic reconstruction for Europe. Its content, however, would be largely dictated by Washington. It is to this end that Clayton's present talks in London are directed." Washington's aim, Novikov explained, was the subordination of the European countries to American capital and the creation of anti-Soviet groupings. Stalin's economic advisor, the Hungarian-born Evgeny Varga, also wrote to Molotov, arguing that Marshall's scheme aimed to forestall America's imminent economic crisis, the approach of which no one in the USA denies. "Washington must, in its own interest," he explained, "grant much greater credits than it has done heretofore just to rid itself of surplus goods at home. Though it knows in advance that part of those credits will never be repaid, it hoped thereby to forge a bloc of bourgeois countries under U.S. domination." Still, Varga, like Novikov, backed Molotov's participation in Paris, no doubt in part because the Central Committee had already done so. Over in London that day, as Novikov had noted, Clayton was meeting with Bevin. The two discussed how American aid could be used to undermine Soviet influence in Europe, even in the East. The Marshall Plan was, Bevin enthused, the quickest way to break down the Iron Curtain. Russia, he wagered, could not hold its satellites against the attraction of fundamental help toward economic revival in Europe. On June 26th, Molotov's plane set down on a baking tarmac at Paris Le Bourget Airport. The city was in the midst of an oppressive heat wave, a mirror image of the bitter cold that had destroyed millions of acres of winter wheat earlier that year. The size of Molotov's entourage, 89 strong, suggested he intended either to engage seriously or to rouse the French communists if he were disappointed. Despite being booted from the French government by a center coalition in May, the communists had more parliamentary seats than any other party, with 90% of the public saying things were going badly or rather badly in France. They were still a political force. Arriving in the early evening at the Quai d'Orsay, home of the French Foreign Ministry since 1853, Molotov wasted little time before probing Bidault for conspiratorial intent. What, he asked, had Paris and London learned from Washington about Marshall's initiative? "Perhaps the two ministers prepared whatever is required," Molotov suggested obliquely. "We did not prepare anything," Bidault protested. "The English government, of course, has its own proposals, and the French government prepared a bit of something from its side as well." "Then the time," Molotov observed, "was not spent in vain after all." "No," Bidault agreed. "The time was, of course, not lost," he said, mirroring the Russian's gentle sarcasm, "because Mr. Molotov was invited." Molotov knew from British Ambassador Sir Maurice Peterson in Moscow that Bevin had brought economic experts to Paris to discuss the plan with Bidault over a week ago. Bidault's protestations confirmed for him that he was walking into a stitch-up. The official business began the following day, June 27. The three delegations assembled in the elegant but intimate Salon des Perroquets, named for the ancient tapestries on the wall. Exercising his prerogative as host, Bideau rose to deliver the formal opening statement. A founding figure of the Christian Democrat MRP Party, 47-year-old Georges Bidet was uniquely positioned to navigate France through the delicate shoals of joining an American-led alliance. The communists to his left would never have crossed Moscow. The Gaullists to his right would never have trusted Washington.